Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
And this is John Romeri, your host, and you're listening to Music from the Tower, coming to you from the beautiful campus of Christ Cathedral, Tower of Hope. And this program highlights classical and sacred music. And today, we have a man who emulates that everywhere, one of the most famous choir directors on the planet, John Alexander. Welcome, John.
Thank you so much, John. Good to be here.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you. John has just finished his 44-year tenure with the Pacific Chorale. How does that feel?
Well, it's pretty well been my life work, but after 44 years, you know, maybe it's time to leave. Conductors usually figure out that you stay with an organization for 10 years at a time. And so after every 10 years, I was evaluating, well, it's time to leave. So I thought, at this point, I'm 72, and I thought, you know, I'm not going to stay another 10 years, so I think this time I better leave.
Well, I don't think there's anybody in Orange County that agrees with that decision in the least, and neither does this old boy. Let me do a little quoting here. Artistic director since 1972, John Alexander is one of America's most respected choral conductors. His inspired leadership, both on the podium and as an advocate for the advancement of the choral art, has generated international respect and acclaim. I couldn't agree more. I've had the pleasure, at least, of being able to enjoy your music making for the last year and a half, but I've certainly known your name for 20 years. I mean, your choral series, your recordings, your enthusiasm, I guess, for new compositions, American music, all your commissioned works. We're going to talk about all of that today with John Alexander and a lot more about the choir, the Pacific Chorale, and the John Alexander Singers. But first, I want to talk about John Alexander. I want to talk about your beginning. Every great musician has a great beginning. And let's hear yours, John. Tell us a little about this family of 11 that you come from and how you became this wonderful musician.
Well, my hometown is New Orleans, but my family came out of the Kentucky Hills. My grandfather was a Southern Baptist hellfire and brimstone preacher in a one-room church out in the country in the hills of Kentucky. But out of that family, there were 11 kids. My dad was the youngest of 11. And when you add up my aunts and uncles and my cousins in this family, there's over a dozen of us that chose choral music as our career.
That's unbelievable.
So it's kind of, and my grandfather, even who the preacher, my grandfather was also a wonderful musician. Oh. And so it just sort of runs in our family. My first instrument, I was a violinist. We were in New Orleans, and the concert mistress of the New Orleans Symphony was a close friend of the family, and I just fell in love with her violin. And so I started on the violin. I thought I'd be an orchestra conductor and break the tradition. But then as I started going and growing, you know, the pull of the choral family just kept going. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to give in, and I will be a choral orchestral conductor. I'll specialize in the choral orchestral work. So.
Which indeed you are, my friend. Indeed you are. I love that hellfire and damnation minister. Maybe that's what gave you that fire to keep a choir of 140 in line. You know, it takes a lot of hellfire, just ask the cathedral choir. So your dad also played, so you two would switch off instruments and learn to improvise.
Right. My dad was an educator, and he worked both at the college level and at the high school level. But I feel it was such a gift that from the time I was very young with my violin, when I started at 4, when I was 5, my dad would go off to work, and he would say, okay, John, I want you to compose a tune on your violin. He said, I want you to create create a piece on your violin, and when I get home from work, I'll play an accompaniment to it. So he got me thinking creatively all the way
from the time
I was 5 years old. And then the next day, he would say, okay, I'm going to give you a folk song, or he would give me a folk song or a hymn tune, and he would just give me the melody. And he would say, now, I'm going to sing this song when you come home, but you have to come to me on the piano. And when I was 5, I started taking piano lessons as well. So then I would work out how to play by ear, basically, is what he was training me to do at that time, to hear harmonies. So absolutely. I wouldn't be the musician. I wouldn't have had the life I've had if it weren't for my dad. He's my greatest mentor.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about great mentors, but I think we've hit on one, haven't we?
That's one very strong one.
Yes. We've had other guests who have said, I don't come from a musical family at all. I'm one of those people. I had a great mentor next door who somehow took me on as a young keyboard player in organ and piano, but I certainly didn't have this kind of heritage. And wow, it's how special to come. And other brothers and sisters also played?
My brother is a pianist, or was a pianist. We just lost my brother in November. But he has made quite a... Reed Alexander is his name. And he was at the University of Illinois, the head of the piano department there for literally his whole adult life. Like, I've been in Orange County. He's been in Illinois for his whole adult life. But he was a wonderful pianist and a wonderful teacher. And my sister is a clarinetist, but that's part of the family. She basically takes care of her children. I mean, that was her life. But
well, you come by this honestly, my friend. It's just amazing. And then you went on to Oberlin for study?
I went on to Oberlin. My dad, when he figured out that the direction I was going, thought I should go to Oberlin. Robert Fountain, he thought, was one of the greatest conductors living at that time, choral conductors. And I agreed with him. I mean, and when I got to Oberlin, what a wonderful mentor Robert Fountain was. He was the director of the Oberlin College Choir then, and I wouldn't take anything from my years at Oberlin. And Fountain was very close to Bob Shaw, Robert Shaw.
Yes.
And Shaw was in Cleveland at the time, and so we got I got to know Shaw while I was a student. We had a lot of communication. We would go in and sing with Shaw in Cleveland, and he would come out to the campus at Oberlin. So he was another early mentor. Another mentor would be Harold Decker, who... for my doctoral studies at the University of Illinois, they were completely different in that Harold was an educator. Fountain was a performer. He taught us how to see music lines and how to see structure and how to build it as he conducted and for us to use in conducting. Harold Decker taught me the love for finding new music, for not just settling into the repetition of the old, to be devoted to the old, but to always be searching for new music, which I've done all of my life. And I take great pride in the amount of American music I've been able to produce and to commission and to record.
Well, and that's a whole little segment that we're going to talk about a little later, but it's bringing music to life is very gratifying, isn't it? It's scary because you think, well, is this piece going to really work? And, you know, is it really going to have a shelf life, or am I just, you know, we'll perform it once, kill ourselves, and that'll be the end of it.
Right.
But you've got some great things coming for us, and we're going to be listening to some of that too. So you went on to the University of Illinois.
From there, I came out here, and I really began serious orchestral conducting studies when I got here. I came for a one-year appointment. I never expected to stay in California. I came for a one-year appointment at Cal State Fullerton, and then I was going to be returning to the Midwest. But I had three job offers before the end of the year, and one was at Cal State Northridge, and I took that. And so for 25 years, I was the director of choral studies there. But what was then the Irvine Master Chorale started... asked me to come and consider taking over the chorale, and the rest is history, I think, in coming from here.
Well, and we're certainly going to talk about that history. I love this one little quote that one of your friends told you, that you'd only work about 3 days a week out here and you'd be at the beach the rest of the time. That's the same baloney that Bishop Van told me. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I never intended to stay in California. And taking the first appointment, that's exactly what happened. Is I thought, well, I'm never going to live in California. That's not, I'm going to go back. I'm going to stay here in the East Coast, because nothing, just like every other Easterner, nothing happens on the West Coast.
Exactly.
You know, there's no reason to be there. But
well,
after so long in school, I loved the idea that he told me, you can go to the beach 3 days a week. And after being in school for 8 straight years, from my undergraduate to my master's, my doctorate, that sounded really good.
Well, we're going to move now to a little bit of music by Morton Lawrence, and certainly a Southern California favorite. But tell us a little bit about this piece, and we're going to be listening to it soon.
As I said earlier, I have wanted to really bring new works in from great American composers. And that's been my mission, part of my mission throughout my life. And specifically, since I'm in Southern California, to specialize in Southern California composers. So Morton Lawrence is of course, now I would say Morton Lordson and Eric Whitaker are the two most famous choral composers from the United States. Their works are known all over the world. And whenever I'm traveling anywhere on tour and bringing American music, they'll say, oh, okay, we want a work of Eric Whitaker, or we want a work of Morton Lordson. So this piece is one that I commissioned called Chanson Éloignée. And we commissioned it for the opening of our new concert hall at the Sangerson Center of the Arts 10 years ago.
Wonderful.
And it's a beautiful text. It's in French. It's a text by Rilke. And it's about the yearning of the heart for song and for love and what it means to be given the gift of singing. So I love the text he chose for it, and I love the piece. And this is a recording of the John Alexander Singers. It's taken from an album of that I called American Voices. We did it in 2013, I think. It's on the Delos label. And it's a recording of all American composers, new music of American composers. So that's
wonderful.
Where this is
recorded. We'll certainly have that on our website. And we'll be back with somebody who's given the gift of music for years and years to Southern California and the whole world. Thank you, John Alexander, and we'll be right back. Music from the Tower and John Alexander. What a treat to have you here, John. We could just go on forever. There's so much to do. We have to do like 5 shows with you. This little segment, I'd like to talk about the Pacific Chorale and its history. Your 44-year history with them is not the whole story, is it?
No, it's not. Actually, the Pacific Chorale will be celebrating its 50th anniversary this coming year.
So it's almost the whole story, but
it's almost the whole story, right. And, you know, while I say that, I want to say just now that I'm retiring at the end of this year, or I just retired. I just did my final concert. And the new artistic director is going to be Robert Eisstadt. And I was one of his mentors. He did his undergraduate with one of my former students, and then in the Midwest. And then my former student, John Hurdy, then sent him to California to study with me. And then I sent him on to study with Bill Denning at USC. But he is a brilliant conductor. He is definitely a star of his generation. We did a national search, and we had wonderful conductors applying.
I'm sure.
But we wound up with deciding Rob was absolutely the right person, even though he was local. So he is going to be the new conductor starting next year for the 50th anniversary. The chorale was founded by Dr. Maurice Allard, and Maurice was the choral conductor at UCI, the first choral conductor at UCI when it that's the University of California in Irvine, when the university first opened. It was when it was very young. And Maurice was a brilliant man. He was interested in a lot of things. He was, his primary interest wasn't actually in choral music. I mean, it was in French solo. His doctoral work at University of Indiana University was in French solo song.
Wow.
But he loved choral music and was good at it. But he also loved musical theater. But he had many, many things, and he was still a young man, not quite sure what he wanted to do. And he started this chorale and was very successful in the initial years of getting it started and situated.
Started back in 1968,
In 68, right. But after 4 years, the chorale had developed this really strong classical masterworks mission that this is what they wanted to be about. And Maurice was moving in different ways. And so they sort of parted ways, I think, in philosophy and what the mission of the organization was. And at that point, they asked me to consider it, and I did and took it. So then I became the conductor in its 5th season, I think it would be.
Wow, what a wonderful move on their part. So it went from a little community chorus, and it was finally the Irvine Master Chorale.
Yeah, it went from Irvine Community Chorus to, at that time, it was called the Irvine Master Chorale. And
not till 81 that it became the Pacific.
Right. It took a number of years for me to convince the board of directors that I thought they were making a mistake with their name, because as soon as, and this is a matter of funding, that any, if you have Irvine in your name, you could get funding for the city, from the city of Irvine, but for anybody else, no, you can't.
Why would I give you money?
Why would I give you money? You just go to your sources in Irvine. Yeah. And our mission already was
way
much
bigger.
much wider than Irvine. So we went through the process, and as the Pacific Symphony was being founded also, we went through this process, both organizations did, of what are we going to use for a name in Orange County? And we didn't like the idea of using a county name, a geographical name. So we got this strange thing of the that we would just use this generic term of being associated with the Pacific Ocean, because Orange County is here on the ocean. So we took the name Pacific Chorale and Pacific Symphony, and then Opera Pacific came in. And so everything in Orange County after that started being known as the Pacifics. Yeah.
Well, here's what the LA Times said. Longtime artistic director John Alexander displays the chorale's stunning range, the command of colors, the dynamics, its texture sensitivity, the vocal power, and the poignancy of its quiet singing. It's the sterling and immaculate collaboration of the Pacific Symphony, the total performance, the model of stylishness. That's pretty good coming from LA Times, don't you think?
Well, I haven't read that before. I really that's very nice.
Well, I'm happy to share that with you. Well, here's one that I think is even more important. It's great to get a nice nod from LA Times or any other reviewer. That's hard enough to do. But really, coming from a choir member is even more special. Here's what one of your singers said about this chorale. Music feeds my soul. For 30 years, the Pacific Chorale has been an essential part of my life, and I dare say John Alexander along with it. To sing and make music with this outstanding group has been the experience of my lifetime. Now that's pretty amazing, isn't it? That it imagine the untold number of singers and students, we'll talk about that a little later, but the untold number of singers that you've touched in those 44 years, my friend, that's pretty fabulous.
Well, that's what makes me happiest. The Pacific Chorale is, the reason I've stayed here so long, I think, is that first of all, when I came here, I thought it would be just a few years and a stepping stone. But then we were building this new Performing Arts Center, and it just looked like this county was going to take off at that time. Because, I mean, Martin Bernheimer from the Times of the Times said, oh, this will never go because that's just, they're going to build a music center in a bean field, which is what South Coast Plaza and the Hope Performing Arts Center was at that time. But we've certainly proved him wrong. He said it will stay empty all the time. It's one of the most wonderful performing arts centers in the country now.
Fantastic.
And our new concert hall is wonderful. But that was a big attraction. And the Pacific Symphony, the founding of the Pacific Symphony, it was really important, because one of my greatest frustrations at the time that I came here was that there wasn't even a symphony down here.
Right. No one's really performed big works in orchestra.
Yeah, and so I built a relationship with Daniel Lewis, who was my mentor in orchestral conducting when I first came here, and building my skills with orchestral conducting. My mentors there are Dan Lewis and George Mester, who was both of them with Pasadena at various times. But we developed a relationship with the Pasadena Symphony. But then the Pacific Symphony came in, and then they appointed Carl St. Clair.
Yes.
And Carl St. Clair is a very strong reason why I have stayed here, because he loves choral music, first of all. He loves choral orchestral literature. He and I developed a friendship immediately when he came here. He wanted to create new choral orchestral masterworks, which I wanted to create also.
Click.
Whereas most choral conductors don't get access to a symphony, our relationship with the symphony, where I have had throughout, ever since it was founded 27 years ago, the Pacific Symphony has been our orchestra for our concert series, and the Pacific Chorale has been the chorale for Carl's, for the orchestra's concert series. So we really, I take great pride in the fact that I think we have produced more new American choral orchestral works between what Carl has done and what I've done than any other place in the country in the last 27
certainly
years.
Certainly two champions. And I think it's wonderful to see many choruses and symphony choruses, the conductor only gets to prepare the chorus and step aside. And it's so wonderful that we got to enjoy the Beethoven Missa Solemnis this year at your baton. You know, we got to enjoy the C Symphony at your baton. And then at the same time, we got to enjoy the same chorus, that same magnificent group of singers doing the Mahler with Carl. You know, so the two of you really have a partnership beyond all telling. Your list of conductors for whom you've prepared choirs goes on like a who's who of American conductors, with Zubin Mehta and Seiji Ozawa and Pierre Boulez. And the list goes on and on. Leonard Slatkin, my old boss in St. Louis. And Michael Tilson Thomas. It just goes on and on and on. And, of course, Dudamel. But I can tell Carl's at the top of your list.
He really is. It's just been a wonderful working relationship. And if you think about the major choral orchestra works that we've created, a work by Philip Glass, that is, by the way, the Symphony and Chorale are going to be doing next year at Carnegie Hall in the spring of next year for a special Glass festival.
We've got to get Rob on and talk about all that's coming.
They're going into that in the spring. But we did commission a work by Elliot Goldenthal that was called the Firework Work Paper. Two works by Richard Daniel Poor, a new work by William Balcom. I mean, it just goes on and on. And a work by Tekeli that I hope we'll be able to play for your audience.
Yes, tell
today.
Us a little bit about that. It's called The Shore.
Frank Tekeli, first of all, I met through the Pacific Symphony. In the United States, he is known by wind orchestra players or band players. They all know him. They play Tekeli. I mean, everybody knows Frank Tekeli. He's like Eric Whitaker in the choral
field.
Everybody knows who Eric Whitaker is.
It's a name I don't know.
In the band world, everybody knows who Frank Tekeli is. But I met him when he was the composer in residence, when Carl chose him very years ago to be the composer in residence for a few years for the Pacific Symphony. And I loved his sense of orchestration and the colors he could create. But he had never composed choral music. And so I was on his back for 2 years saying, you're going to write me a choral piece.
And was The Shore the piece?
No, it was an a cappella piece. There Would Be Rest, which is also maybe something we can let your audience hear tonight.
We can put a link.
It was a beautiful a cappella piece, his first offering, and it became so popular that it had the highest sales of any choral piece in this country for choirs to perform.
Wow.
In the year that I published it in my series. So it just immediately took off, and I said, you see, you have a real talent in choral music here.
Tell us about The Shore.
The Shore is a symphony that he wrote, a choral orchestral piece that was written to honor my 40th anniversary with the chorale.
Wonderful.
And he asked me about works I love, and one I said, well, one orchestral work I love is the C Symphony of Vaughan Williams, and it's something I've lived with all of my life. And in fact, I chose that piece with the Walt Whitman text as the final piece I would do with the Pacific Chorale just a few weeks ago, ending my tenure as artistic director.
So we're going to hear a little bit about this, and we will be right back with a whole lot more from John Alexander and about the Pacific Chorale tours in the next segment. Stay tuned. This is John Romero, and we're Music from the Tower. And today's guest is John Alexander. And as we went off to break, we were talking just about a brand new piece that John commissioned. And it's called The Shore. And we've been listening to the third movement called The Black Gondola. Tell us just a little bit more about this piece, John.
The poet for this symphony, the poet he uses, four poems by David St. John. And it goes through, all the poetry deals with where the land meets the sea. And following the concept of Vaughan Williams' Sea Symphony. The first movement is a boy, a child, walking on the beach, and specifically about Moonstone Beach up in Cambria. So it's,
wow,
it's
okay.
A California subject.
California piece.
The second movement is Adolescence. The third movement that we were just listening to is The Black Gondola, and it's set in Venice, and it's about this fear of death and coming to realities with problems in life, and it's devilish. I just love the third movement. And then finally, a beautiful fourth movement called Redemption.
Our listeners need to know that they can always hear the entire piece by going to our website and clicking the little link, and you can even actually still purchase all of these things by checking out our website at ChristCathedralMusic.org. This segment, I'd like to talk about the chorus and their touring. In your 44 years, you took this choir to 27 countries. I'm exhausted just thinking about it. I've toured my choirs, to a few European capitals, went to France, Canada one time. 27 countries, John? That's like the whole world.
It's been a lot of touring. But, from the beginning, my idea in touring when I started back in the 70s, when I first took this choir, I had the crazy idea that for the first tour that we would go from Paris to Prague and on a
wow.
European tour. So we spent most of our life in buses.
Did you just open the window, sing, and keep driving?
Exactly. It just kept going. But I feel like traveling together and being able to do programming multiple times is what helps create a family
in
a choir.
There's nothing like it.
There's nothing like it.
It's some of my greatest memories as a choral conductor. I mean, people often say, what was your greatest thing? And, I'd like to ask you that question. But certainly for me, touring was it.
Yeah.
Taking my choir, seeing my choir on Canterbury steps and seeing them in the Vatican and seeing them in St. Stephen's in Vienna. You can't forget it. St. Florian Abbey with Thal Bruckner and, these wonderful concerts in these great places.
Yeah.
Makes the music come alive for our singers, doesn't it? To sing right. it in that place.
It's an extraordinary experience. And for our seasons here, our singers have as many as 150 calls in a year. That's how much work.
Right.
If they did everything that the Pacific Chorale wants to do. That's a lot of calls, a lot of rehearsals. But they became so dedicated to this because they became a family.
Right.
And I say that started from the concept of touring from
Absolutely.
The beginning. And it
I
is a great, great asset
agree.
For the organization. And then as we grew in our artistic stature, it became as much a musical thing too, in that I wanted to bring American music to Europe that they didn't know. And I wanted to bring European music to America. And for instance, we went to Estonia a number of years ago and worked with the Estonian National Symphony and did some American music and some European music. But then we've worked with the L'Orchestre Lamoureux in Paris and did a Brahms Requiem in the Madeleine. We've been in South America with the National Philharmonic of Buenos Aires and in China with the Shanghai Symphony. Mendelssohn Elijah, if you can believe it, which is what they wanted us to do.
Wow.
Mendelssohn Elijah with the Shanghai Symphony and with the National Symphony in Beijing and with the Hong Kong Symphony. I mean, I thought that's the strangest repertoire in the world, but that's what they wanted us to do was a Mendelssohn Elijah. But it's been a great experience. And in the last ones, for instance, we just took a tour last summer to Budapest, and I wanted to feature the works of András Virág, who is a great organist out of Budapest. And so I did some of his music, and then I brought him over here. He's a great organist and a great composer, and he did his wonderful organ Fantasia.
I was here. I enjoyed that
concert. Our beautiful,
it was amazing.
Yeah. And one of my favorite tours of all times was the tour that we did to Paris, France. And it wasn't a tour. It was going to one city. And so rather than my initial thing of going to Paris and Prague, I went just to Paris.
Mm.
But we did four different repertoires,
In four different locations?
In four different locations,
wow.
Right. We did the Durfle Requiem in Saint-Étienne-du-Mont, which was Durfle's church.
Of course.
And we did the Faure Requiem in the Madeleine, which is other French works too, but it's all French programming in the Madeleine. And then we did Daniel Ross worked with us in the
Saint-Sulpice.
Saint-Sulpice, thank you. And we did the great masses of Vidor and the great motets of Vidor and Vierne, who come from that two-organ tradition. Just extraordinary things. But the musician that I wanted to feature was Thierry Eskes in this whole process. And Eskes is the organist at at Durfleisch Church. He's at Saint-Étienne-du-Mont as well as being on the composition and organ faculty at the Conservatoire in Paris. He is a phenomenal organist and a phenomenal composer. And the choral world does not know his music.
Well, I told you before we began to tape, I was the dean of the AGO in Philadelphia. We had him in Philadelphia for 3 days. He did a fantastic organ concert. He did organ master classes. And the word choral never came up in 3 days. You know, so it's not a name that everybody thinks of as choral
right,
music.
Right.
But leave it to John Alexander to dig it right out of him. Okay.
Well, I'm a great advocate for him, and I want more American choirs to know that this man has fantastic choral music.
Marvelous
yeah.
musician. I
so
can't wait to learn.
We actually did, I was talking about our Budapest contact with Virag. We premiered a work here in the United States of his that no Hungarian choir would take on. But we took it on and did it, and it was quite beautiful. And for Thierry, we did his three motets with the John Alexander Singers, both here and in Paris at Saint-Étienne-du-Mont. And extraordinary work for choir and organ. And Thierry is, of course, the organist that performed with us.
I brought
him here.
In both places?
In both places.
Oh,
he came
great.
Here and did all our Durfleisch Requiem. He was the organist for it. We did the middle version.
Wonderful.
But we did this set of motets. And the one that I hope your audience is going to be able to hear now is the third motet of that series, which is a Kyrie. And it's an extraordinary composition. I think... From the first 5 seconds, you can tell this is a special composer and a special piece. I can't say it's very easy, but it's great.
That's the trouble with all this modern music. It's not easy.
Well, but the wonderful thing about having a group like Pacific Crowell and John Alexander Singers is that they are such extraordinary musicians that we can become advocates of this music that is very, very difficult that most choirs can't handle. Balkum, Eskesh, Virag. I mean, they're all, they require considerable skill, and I'm thrilled that we've been able to build this choir of this. That I mean, they are phenomenal musicians, both 30 professional singers we have, and we generally sing with like 120 volunteers. We change our size depending upon what it's going to be.
And how often do they rehearse?
Our rehearsal schedule is varied according to repertoires. Generally, there's a rehearsal for the Crowell every Monday night. There's a rehearsal for John Alexander Singers every Tuesday night. But then on some weeks, they're out 5 and 6 nights a week.
Right.
But we have a roster of something like 200 singers, the way I do it. We do as many as 18 repertoires in a year. So everybody can't do that with the volunteers. Our professionals, of course, want the work, and they're thrilled.
Of course, happy to do it.
They come to us because we give them work to do. Our volunteers get to choose different works. They get to say, I can do this, I can do this, and do this. So we have a roster of some 200 singers, about 40 professionals, and 160, 170 volunteers, something like that. And then we choose, for each repertoire, we choose a choir from that list, both how many we want to sing and depending upon who wants to do it from the volunteer base.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, let's go back to Thierry Eskesh and let's listen to Motet 3, shall we?
Sounds good.
This is the Kyrie from that, and this is Thierry at the organ?
Thierry at the organ.
And John Alexander, of course, as conductor. We will be back with a lot more from Thierry Eskesh and from John Alexander. And this is Music from the Tower. We'll be right back. And we are back. This is Music from the Tower, finishing up with one of the most fascinating guests we've enjoyed, our friend John Alexander, and hearing all about the Pacific Chorale, his 44-year tenure there. But we want to take a little different direction. We want to talk about John as educator. We've talked a lot about Champion for American Music, and certainly you have been my friend. You've been instrumental in Chorus America. But let's talk about your teaching years, 25 years at Cal State Northridge, and 10 more years at Cal State Fullerton. That's a lot of musicians you've touched.
It's a lot of years of teaching, but teaching's in my blood. It comes from my dad, I think. And, you know, late in my life, my dad entered an inner-city school in New Orleans, an all-black school that had where they had done nothing but sing. And the marching band just, they didn't play instruments, they only marched. And the singers did nothing but sing in unison. And he went and built and showed, he wanted to prove that you could go into that inner-city school, and if you worked at it, you could create something. He created this unbelievable music program there where the kids were singing with the New Orleans Symphony. So he was an inspiration to me. In my own life as an educator, basically there are two driving principles. Number one, to try to work out something where singers are taught musicianship skills in the same way the instrumentalists are taught musicianship skills.
It's a big deal, isn't it?
It's a big deal. It is a wonderful thing that everybody can sing, and that a group sing of just people on the street singing together. It is absolutely an astounding, wonderful thing. There's very strong movements today to increase more of that. I'm totally behind that. But it can't replace the concept of building the skills, because I personally would rather hear polyphony than a unison line when I'm listening to music, except for Gregorian chant.
Okay, point taken.
Except for Gregorian chant.
Yes, but you still must be a skilled musician. I can't tell you the big disappointment of hearing staff singers come to audition, and, you know, they have this gorgeous instrument, and they sing a piece. And it's absolutely wonderful, very heartfelt, very musical. And then the next thing you know, it's sight reading time and they can't sing two notes in a row.
Yeah.
You know, that nobody has taken them aside and built those skills inside of them to be able to really, they have coaches that, you know, they coach on this piece and they're all set and they go out and they coach on these operas and they go out and sing. But it's the musicianship. They can't go any farther than some coach or some teacher can take them. You know, they don't have it inside.
I totally agree. One of the worst things I have to deal with, and the reason I'm so committed to this, the later in life I get, the more committed I am.
Me too.
Is to hear when I'm auditioning for my professional singers, and there's a list of 60 singers trying to get five openings.
Exactly.
I have. And these singers come in and they have a master's degree in music in performance from a university, from someplace, and they cannot pass a basic rhythm test that is taken from a sixth grade band book.
Yep. Yep.
And so there's something wrong with our process.
There's something wrong.
And so I've spent my life trying to build techniques to build musicianship within the choral rehearsal. So in teaching that, to aid singers so that they can be paid to have professional positions and really be professional musicians and not just beautiful voices. It hurts to hear this beautiful voice that has been so well trained, but that they don't have the musical capabilities to pursue.
They just don't have the chops.
To move forward. And the other thing is the training of conductors. My love is the choral orchestral works. And in this country, choral conductors are trained, you know, they go off on, you go to the left side of the road if you have a background in singing or in choral music, or say you're in choral music, and your studies stay on that left side of the road. For the person that's the oboist or the string player, and you say, I'm interested in conducting, they send you to the right side of the road in an opposite direction, so to speak, preparing you to be an orchestral conductor. And to me, that's not the way to teach conducting. It needs to be taught with both. But I want to preserve the choral orchestral literature for all the conductors. I've worked with some wonderful conductors. Some of the world's most astounding conductors, as you mentioned, orchestral conductors.
Yes.
The problem is, so many orchestral conductors are scared to death of the course because they don't have proper training in it.
Right. It has to be both, don't you think?
Yeah. And the choral conductor does the same thing when they get up to conduct.
In front of an orchestra.
When they get up to conduct the Mozart Requiem, they haven't the foggiest idea what to do with the instruments and are scared to death of it. And so consequently, very often the choral people think the orchestral musicians are mean and ugly, and the orchestral musicians think the choruses are stupid. And
so, boy, I couldn't have phrased it better. You know, it's exactly right. It's, and you know, and I just love equating and constantly telling my choirs to go listen to symphonic plays. Mm. You know, go to the symphony and watch the violins. That's the kind of musicianship that you have to put into your choral lines. Yeah. You know, give it more bowing. Pull that bow more. You know, it's all about the equating of music inside beats, that whole package that we fail in many of our universities and colleges to give our choral conductors. They don't have it, you know, and they don't know how to say enough with their hands. You know, they say too much with their mouth.
And there's an issue of inner rhythm, too. I mean, I think that choirs are so used to thinking horizontally, and vertical rhythm just doesn't fit together. And it's very difficult. I mean, text requires the consonants are not on the beat, they're before the beat, and
right.
So forth. So there's,
really
in reality, rhythmic intensity that absolutely requires that a singer has a sense of a good sense of inner rhythm, which is, of course, what one of my mentors, Robert Shaw, was all about. And he was absolutely right. But that it's been the goal of my life to create rhythm and to change the rehearsal process of a choir so that you start with rhythm and you don't start with just let's all sing the tune along and then play it on the piano and learn it by rote.
And as soon as my neighbor moves, I'm going to move along with him.
Yeah.
You know, because there's nothing inside. Yeah. It's constant.
But the truth is, orchestral musicians love singers. I want to say this since what we said before, a few minutes ago. Orchestral musicians love singers when they can sing and join them in this music making, when they aren't dragging along behind rhythm and delivery, but part of it. This Pacific Symphony players love the Pacific Chorale, and the Pacific Chorale loves the Pacific Symphony. It's because they have reached together in a musical sense where they are equals.
Well, you and Carl have made that one unit.
Well,
yeah.
It's been a good relationship all these years, yeah. I'll tell you.
It's so obvious from the audience point. You know, it's just absolutely obvious that this is one giant unit. And Carl's equally at home with the chorus, and you're equally at home with the orchestra. You know, it's not like you're only tending to the choir and somehow the orchestra makes it through.
Yeah.
You know, and that's often the case, you know. The orchestra is completely ignored by a choral conductor who gets up there.
True.
Well, let's talk about Chorus America. You were a board member. You were the national president.
I have been, I think I have the longest tenure. I'm on my second tenure. So after 9 years, you have to go off. But then I was the president of the organization. So then you stay on an extra year. And then you have to, you stay on another year because you're the past president and so forth. So I think then I started a second tenure. So I've been on the Chorus America board for over 20 years.
Well, and part of Endowment for the Arts and California Arts and LA Commission for the Arts. I mean, you've just been that champion in so many ways, and what a distinguished leader. You must be so proud of this incredible gift that you've given to students, to chorus members, to just the musical field that we've all enjoyed. So what's the next chapter for John Alexander? Of course, you're going to be all over the place, being asked to be guest conductors and all sorts of other things. That's no doubt. I saw your name already. You're going to be conducting the Messiah next year,
right?
At Segerstrom. But what are some hopes? What's on your bucket list?
I have no problem with staying busy. Many of my singers are afraid I'm going to bury myself in my house and close the door see me again. Watch the prices, right? Well, that's not my life plan. Okay, this summer I'm doing a week long orchestral conducting workshop for choral conductors. It's a Chorus America national workshop, but we have a faculty of four. Rob Eisted's going to be joining on it, and David Hayes, the director of orchestral studies at Manus, is joining me, and Dwayne Wolf, the Chicago Symphony Chorus Director, is going to be joining me. But our idea is, which I talked about before, is creating an opportunity for choral conductors to feel comfortable with the orchestra, to work with the strings specifically.
Well, David is another master at that.
We're doing a week-long workshop at Cal State Fullerton. I'm doing another one. I'm doing one in New York in January. This is something that's very much on my plate, okay, in trying to help choral conductors of the young generation. There are so many fantastic conductors out there that just haven't had enough opportunity for experience with players yet with the instrumentalists because their program is separated from the instrumental program, as we talked about right. before. So,
well, John,
that's major.
You have given so much to the choral world, and it sounds like there's a lot more to be given. And we're so grateful for the taking an hour with us and our listeners. Let's talk about the very last piece you're going to share. There shall be rest. There will be rest. I hope that's not going to happen very soon for you, my friend. I am thrilled to know that there are much more musical adventures, many, many more adventures coming your way. John, thank you so much for being with us. Tell us a little bit about this last piece.
This last piece was, I mentioned it earlier, it was the very first choral piece that Frank Tekeli wrote for me. Right after I commissioned it, Carl St. Clair's young son was killed in a tragic accident, in a swimming pool accident, when he was still a baby.
Yeah.
But it is a beautiful, beautiful statement. The poetry is lovely. It's the Pacific Choral singing a cappella.
John Alexander, what a great pleasure to be with you. You've been listening to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri. And until next time, please get out there and listen to some live performances of some great music. Thanks for listening.